Hi, everybody. Welcome to Paul Lisnick Behind the Curtain, my chance to step away from the worlds of politics and law you watch me cover every day on the television side of WGN into the world, my passion of theater and the arts over on the radio side with our podcast Behind the Curtain. And this is going to be fun today because I think we're talking about a Christmas movie or not. I think we are talking about a Christmas message or not. But I do know we're talking about one of the great action films of all time. And we're going to do this in a different way than you've ever seen me do this podcast before. We'll explain in a minute. First, let me introduce my guest to you. And that is Richard Marsh. Richard is a performer. Actually, I need to start, Richard, by calling you a poet, which, to be honest, when I went into this, I didn't know that was kind of your primary focus was to be seen. We do see you as a poet first.
Yes, so what I've done here in writing UPKA is I've chosen to retell Die Hard as an epic poem combined with dialogue, combined with storytelling, combined with theatre. So it's a sort of a big mashup of different styles. It's not stand-up comedy, but it's very sort of fourth wall-breaking, audience-forward theatre. And that's how I started writing it, actually, was I've always been interested in using poetry to tell stories which maybe don't seem like they would be poetry. So what's the opposite of poetry? An action movie. What's the greatest action movie? Obviously, it's Die Hard. That is the greatest action movie. So, and that made me laugh. That apparent kind of contrast made me laugh. And then beyond that, this is, I don't know if you're filming this or not for your podcast, but if this is an audio podcast, then...
Yes, well, it's both. People can see you or hear you.
Okay, great. So then... If you can't see me, I'm a bespectacled, skinny English bloke. And to me, that was the idea of me playing, you know, Hollywood hero John McClane. That was another very funny thing. And so that's two funny reasons to start writing this show. And I often start with comedy. I often start with things which make me laugh. And then the task is to sort of bottom that out and find a humanity and a truth within that. And in this case, it was both within retelling Die Hard itself, but also in the sort of the personal story I tell alongside it. So if you come to the show expecting Die Hard comedy, you will get that, but you also get an emotional story as well.
Yeah, and of course, we should just say, we'll say it again, but it's playing at the Broadway Playhouse through December 15th. That is actually that's the theater that I used for my Broadway show, our television show, which went on until COVID. So I know the space you're in, and it's a great space. So as you got into this project, one of the things you write in a writer's note in the program is to say you always start with the humor and then you try and find the humanity in the humor. How does that happen here? How did it happen here?
So it was partly, well, in the two sections of the story. So in Die Hard, what I'm able to do is the characters are able to talk to the audience. They're effectively able to kind of give soliloquies. So it's a bit like in a musical when a character gets a song and it can tell you exactly what they're feeling, right? And so take a character like Holly McClane, who's played in a movie by Bonnie Medina, fantastic actor. And you get a lot of sense of who Holly is. She's not always the focus of the film, right? But you get a lot of sense of who she is and how she feels about her husband at different points. But what I'm able to do is I'm able to give her, she's able to talk to the audience and tell you. So we're able to kind of delve into that a bit more, perhaps, than the movie has time to, because it's focused elsewhere. And then the other emotional and part of it is, within the movie side of it again, is that when I first saw the film as a teenager, it was to me like clearly the story of a hero kicking ass. Or ass, as you might say. And as I watch it now, when I came to adapt it, watching it in sort of midlife, I'm a dad, yeah, I'm much more taken by the story of the marriage as well as the story of the action. And so, you know, John and Holly, like many couples, they've argued at Christmas time. And unlike many couples, they're unable to reconcile because of terrorist action. But There is a truth, I think, to Die Hard in the story of their marriage and their emotions. You know, John's fighting to kind of beat the baddies. He's fighting to kind of get back to Holly and try and sort of save her. But the reason he's doing that is because he messes up at the beginning of the film. He's rude to her. He's cross because she's using her maiden name. And he, you know, Bruce Willis bangs his head against the doorway and says, you know, that he's messed up. And so we're able to really lean into that kind of that aspect of the movie more in our play than the movie has time to do, I think. So that's the one aspect. And then the other aspect is in the personal story that I tell alongside it, which is I tell a story of what it is to be a fan of the movie and what it is to be the fan of the movie as your life changes and your circumstances change. Because I don't know if you find this, Paul, but if you say, if you have a piece of music which you listen to when you were a teenager, and you listen to it again in your 20s and again in your 30s, it's going to hit differently at each of those times because it has what it means to you now, but also it has the echoes of what it was to you, you know, previously in your life. And so, to me, what I'm trying to do in the play is tell the story of Die Hard as a fan, while also telling the story of being a fan of Die Hard, and by extension of kind of all art. And so that's what I'm attempting to do anyway. And that's one of the things which I realized during the writing of it, and definitely I've tried to sort of bring out as I rewrote it and polished it as we came close to the final production.
And by the way, I agree with you on the movie. In fact, for me, the music you would reference might be the Beatles. So please, when you go back to England, if you pop through Liverpool, give my thanks for having them stay with us for so long and forever. So here's what you've just referenced it, but it's something I did not know. I mean, there wasn't a lot of homework to do for the show before I went. I knew I was going to see Die Hard presented by you. I did not know we would see it in poetry form, which is amazing. And I didn't know we were going to get the juxtaposition of your personal life along with it. So I thought that was absolutely amazing. We're going to dissect all of that in just a bit. But I do want to acknowledge one other thing. You have an alternative. This is a one-man show, one-person show, and it is you. But there is an alternative you who also plays several performances. And I met him at the opening. And so I was it was sort of interesting because I thought, oh, you must travel everywhere together. And this is the routine everywhere you go. That's not how this works. But he is with you in Chicago. So Daryl Bailey, lovely gentleman. But talk a little bit about, because when someone comes to see this at Broadway Playhouse through December 15th, they're likely to get you, but they may just get Daryl.
They might get Daryl, yes. So he's doing three shows a week. So for me, it's lovely that Daryl's here. Firstly, because he's a nice chap. We've become friends over the course of making the show. But also, usually on tour, it's me, and I'm doing eight shows a week. And here I get three shows off. And as someone who is a big fan of Chicago, it means I get to, it hasn't actually happened yet because I've done every show so far, but we're only two shows in so far, but I will have time to go and see other theatre, comedy, see some poetry. And like, this is part of the thrill for me about being in Chicago, and particularly being here for a month, is it's been a city I've always been fascinated with. So like, I read David Mamet's Writing in Restaurants when I was a student, and I'm sitting there in kind of cafes at the Edinburgh Fringe, kind of scribbling away in my notebooks, you know. And I've seen Steppenwolf play in London, and Chicago is, as I understand it, I think where kind of slam poetry began. And you know, my career, I've done a lot of poetry slam, and so there's all these things which have sort of been part of my journey to who I am now, and why I've chosen to retell this story in this way. Seem to me to have come out of this city, and to be here for, you know, a run of almost a month, and to have some shows which I'm not performing, so hopefully I can go and see other things. And I talk to the audiences after the show, and people are very, very kind. Some people have got in touch online and sort of said, here's some poetry places you could check out, or here's, you know, there's this production Macbeth you've got to go and see, Invictus Theatre, and hopefully I'm going to get a chance to sort of see some of these things while I'm here. And also go to some restaurants. That's the other thing I'm keen to do.
Yeah, and I'm sure you found Garrett's popcorn and all the pizza places.
I have not, but I'm going to write that down now.
You definitely want the Garrett's cheese corn pop caramel corn mix. We'll talk about that some other time. And as you were saying that, I too am saying, okay, I've got to send you a whole list of plays you need to go, like Falsettos down over at the Court Theater. Lots of things for you to do and see. Enjoy your days off. But we're going to talk about Yippee-ki-yay. For folks who don't know the movie, by the way, Yippee-ki-yay is a phrase we attach to the movie.
Yes. So it's sort of John's catchphrase in the movie. He essentially says Yippee-ki-yay, and then a curse word I won't say on this podcast. Please. But we've chosen to edit the title to a judicious point for that reason.
Exactly. So now we're going to do something a little bit different, Richard. And I'm going to bring in my producer, Julian, who doesn't ever join me on these podcasts. He sits back and watches. I don't know what he's doing actually when we do them, but he sits back and hopefully he's enjoying them. But Julian's going to come in, and here's why. Because I, and you asked the audience this, by the way, at the beginning of the show, how many of you have seen Die Hard? And of course, most people start applauding and cheering. And then you ask for the few of us who embarrass ourselves, who hasn't ever seen Die Hard. And there I was. I just haven't seen Die Hard. But Julian came to the performance as well. He is, Julian, your phrase, a diehard fan.
Yes, diehard fan.
So we decided that we would do something a little differently, which is that I would ordinarily go see the movie or watch the movie before seeing the show. But I went, no, you know what? I won't do that. Let me give you my experience. Julian will have his, and you get to respond to everything. So actually, Julian, I'll let you kick it off. So as somebody who loves Die Hard, as you sat through this, What experience did you, it's going to, Richard, this is your interview, but I just got to let Julian say this. What was your experience as you watched Richard present Die Hard in this way?
So much like you, Paul, I had no idea what to expect coming into this. I wanted to come in blind. I didn't research. I didn't know who Richard Marsh was. I was going to come in and enjoy it. And I was not expecting a slam poetry retelling of Die Hard with personal story mixed in. And I was blown away. I was impressed.
Thank you.
Yeah, and you can't get a better compliment than that. Don't you? Isn't this great? Two people didn't do any homework before they came. Well, there's a reason we ordinarily do. Not this time we didn't. And so let me ask you first of all, in selecting this one, I don't know if you addressed this when I first kicked this off. Is Die Hard a Christmas movie?
Absolutely, it is. I can fully get behind and say it's clearly a Christmas movie. It's one I watch all year round, but it's a Christmas movie. I think the reason for this sort of the incredibly controversial statement this has become is because I feel there's an unspoken assumption behind the phrase Christmas movie, which is that a Christmas movie is a movie that is not only set at Christmas, but that you can watch with children. And Die Hard is a movie which is set at Christmas, but I would not watch it with my kids. They're not old enough yet, you know. I think that's where it comes from, is there's just a sort of an unspoken assumption behind it, which is what leads to the controversy. That's my belief as to why there's this great debate.
I thought you had to have Christmas music and elves and Santa running around or something, but...
They've got Christmas music and a Santa hat, don't they? They don't have elves.
That's a start. Julian, I'm going to let you kick this off with a... Go ahead and ask Richard a question from the Die Hard fanatic perspective.
So one thing that I really enjoyed was how you, not only did you explain it thoroughly, I feel like a blind person would have been able to enjoy it just as much as someone watching it, because you were very thorough, and I loved your placement of the henchman.
Thank you. That was
perfect. And I loved how you almost recreated the cinematography of certain scenes. The light was very much your best friend during this whole show.
Yeah, Julian told me about that afterwards. He talked about how, and he has a better eye than me for this, but as you shifted to personal things, there were clearly light cues and things that changed where we were and who you were talking about.
Yes, you had that little musical stinger to indicate, okay, we're going back to the personal story, and then now we're back to Die Hard.
You're absolutely correct. Not everyone, I think, consciously realizes that like you have, but I think it has a storytelling effect whether you realize consciously or not. So our lighting was designed by Robbie Butler, and it's sort of relit and operated on tour by Benji Adams. He also operates our sound, which is designed by, it's in a program, Ben.
Don't worry, I'll get it for you.
Okay, thank you. That's terrible. I think the light and sound do a huge job in a story. Ben Hudson, thank you. And the sound, which designed by Ben Hudson and operated again by Benji. And I think one of the really fun things is I'm pointing my finger guns and you get this massive Hollywood sound effect. And so there's sort of a lovely comedy in that. And I think now Daryl is doing the show, I've been able to watch it. And one of the things I enjoy as an audience member is being complicit in the theatricality and the playfulness of this idea of we're all going to sit here and we're going to believe that this person with one stool is doing all of the stunts in Die Hard. And whether it be the waterfall, whether it be the fire hose, I feel like there's this sort of childlike glee in just pretending together in a big room full of people and laughing and pretending. And so I think you're right, the light and the sound do a huge job to help that, and also help the clarity with the personal story in a Die Hard story.
So Richard, is the character we see on stage, Richard Marsh, who seems very real, very Richard to us, is he a fictional person for us?
He is a version of myself. So he is a person who I've spent a lot of time studying over many years and watching his work, watching him develop, watching him go through life until a point at which I was able to sort of write him and bring him to life. So he lives through versions of what I've lived through in my life, but with some of the details changed.
And now let me ask you a question for those who have not seen the film, because as they watch the interaction between you and Julian, they're, you know, the Die Hard people go, oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah. So for those who don't watch Die Hard, and again, you know, you asked it at the beginning, who hasn't seen it? So what was in your mind, both in creating this piece and then also in the performing, knowing I have some people, maybe it's one person, maybe it's 20, but I have people in this audience at the Broadway Playhouse who have never seen it. So what is your mission for them?
So it's a very good question. It was very important to me when I wrote this was to tell the story of Die Hard for people who haven't seen the movie as well, because I had a feeling, and it turned out to be correct, that often you might get, say, a couple, and one of them is a big fan of the movie and one of them hasn't seen it. Or you might get people who, Die Hard's been out since 1988. They could have seen this film 30 years ago, and so maybe they remember about his feet, or they remember he jumps off the, you know, the top of the building, but they don't remember the details of it. So people may have seen it and just not remember all of it. So it's very important to me that you would have a good experience if you came to this show never having seen Die Hard. I don't want to kind of keep those people closed off from it. And I think I've had people come and say, I haven't seen Die Hard, but I now feel like I have, which is a sort of a lovely thing for them to say. They will discover when they see the movie that it rhymes less, and there is a bigger cast, but there are differences. But I try to make it a really good experience for people who haven't seen it. I think it's probably a better experience if you have. The other thing is people often do their homework before they come, and they watch Die Hard in order to watch UPKA. So a lot of people have seen it maybe a long time ago. A lot of people saw it last night as well. So it's a big contrast between the different people.
And by the way, there's other references. I don't want to give things away. I don't like to give little secrets away, but there are references that you made. And as I sat there listening, going, I wonder why said that reference. And then Julian, after the show, explained it to me that sometimes it had to do with somebody who stars in the movie, which then immediately I got. I went, okay, I get it. But because I kept myself from seeing the movie this late, I needed Julian to help me. So Julian, thank you for that. Julian, I'll turn back to you as the diehard fan. How else do you, what else are you wondering about?
One thing that crossed in my mind earlier was, do you see a difference in reaction between US and UK audiences?
Yes, absolutely. So I'll give you an example of how I had to change the show when we came over here. So we opened this show in the States. We actually had toured last year. We started in Des Moines and we ended up in Denver. And when we opened in Des Moines, I realized that when I started playing Hans, and I talk in the version now, I talk about how Alan Rickman, who plays Gruber, makes a very interesting choice as an actor in that he chooses to play Hans Gruber, a man so German his name is Hans Gruber, basically with his own English accent, just changing the odd syllable here and there. And that wasn't in the show until the second night in Des Moines, because the first time I did it in Des Moines, I think the audience didn't realize that Hans wasn't speaking in a German accent. And so in the UK, everybody got that. But the impression I got anyway, I could be wrong, was that it wasn't necessarily clear that I was playing an English guy, playing a German guy in an English accent when I was in America, and I was also doing John, and I was doing all these other accents. And so there were little things like that where I had to just clarify things for a different audience with different kind of expectations. And the other thing is, I would say generally American audiences are really vocal. They're really loud, which is really nice. I really appreciate that. And I guess the other thing is some of the references I've kind of like tweaked, for example, what chicken restaurant they eat at, or I've tweaked,
like the KFC. Oh no, KFC works everywhere, I think.
So KFC works everywhere, but there's another one called Nando's, which actually you have in Chicago.
Yeah, we do.
Change to Popeyes here, but
great garlic bread, by the way.
Very true. So little things like that. But basically speaking, the show, once I made those few tweaks to kind of make things work in the US, that the show kind of, honestly, it works pretty well everywhere, actually. Like it's you know, we've been polishing and crafting it now for 2 years, and I'm always trying to kind of rework it and kind of improve a little bit. So like the ballet fight you see at the end, Carl's kind of ballet fight with John, that wasn't in the show before this tour.
Ah. Where did you add in, again, not giving things away, but I'll just say you use some British terms and or English terms that an English person would use. I got them because I have some British family. But that being said, you help us with that. That certainly is nothing you say in England, I wouldn't think. At what point, was it Des Moines? Where were you when you went, I better explain it? Because I took the explanation as like a joke. I kind of like, I do know what that is. I think it's a bit tongue-in-cheek, but where did you add that in?
So I thought before I came over here, what is and isn't going to play over here? And I got a couple of American friends to read the script as well. And so, you know, I write a lot of scripts for telly and film scripts as well. And when you're moving, if you're sending a script to people in America, it's useful to change like kind of petrol for gas, for example, or hood for bonnet and lift for elevator. So I sort of, some things like that I anticipated. And then if I'm going to make that change, I want to try and do something more than simply make a change. So the moment you've referred to in the play, we get an extra joke out of it, which is really nice. And I think all the opportunities I have to sort of talk to the audience and play with them and have them interact with me, I kind of seek those out because those are really fun as a performer.
And Julian, I'll come back to you after this question, but one of the great, again, this was in your note in the program, Richard, but you talk about the fact that Stephen D'Souza, who co-wrote the screenplay for Die Hard, that he went from, and I'm not sure how you found all this out, but he went from saying, call my lawyers and go after this guy, seeing the show and saying, no, I think I'm going to call my friends and tell them to go see this show. Was that was there a real scare there of fear? But it obviously comes out great.
So that's Stephen. So he's being funny when he says that quote, right? He's a very funny man. So he's joking, but we did the show at Wilton's Music Hall in London in 2023, and some people from an action movie festival, a London action festival, came to see the show. And I think the festival was in June or July, and Stephen was flying over to do some screenings of, I think, maybe Predator or some other of his movies anyway. And they thought it'd be fun to organize a performance of Yippee-ki-yay for Stephen to come and watch. There's a fire truck going past. Can you hear it?
Yes, that's our first responders on top of something.
Yeah, there we go. They're on their way to Nakatomi Tower. They thought, should we try and organize a performance so Stephen can watch it? And I was super excited, but very nervous, because I think although it's clearly the work of a diehard fan, it's clearly the work of someone who absolutely loves Die Hard, possibly a bit too much. But also, you know, we have fun with the film, you know, we change bits of it. And I was, you know, somewhat nervous as to what he would think. But he was incredibly generous and kind person. He's got a great sense of humor. He's incredibly entertaining company. I got to do a Q&A with him. I got to have dinner with him. And, you know, now, you know, I get to email Stephen and it's, you know, he's giving me advice on another script. I feel just, I can't quite believe this has happened, to be honest. But it's,
well, he has filed a lawsuit. I've got the paperwork here.
Got to talk to the producer.
Yeah, exactly. Julian, a question from a diehard fan.
You mentioned changing things as you've gone along. So you're in your ninth run now. This is, what was it, opening night. Do you see anything changing for the 10th run or things that you might change for the better or things that just maybe didn't work?
Or when you leave us, you go on to Toronto. Will the thing being changed because Canadians were pretty close to Americans, but not exactly.
So I don't at the moment have things I want to change. Things probably will come up during this run. And if they do, I'll either kind of work them in or think about them for the future. Like right now, we've just done a whole bunch of changes. So we're very lucky. The producer really believes in the show and he gave us some time to kind of workshop it over summer and put in the new kind of the sequence we were talking about earlier. I always learn stuff from watching Daryl. Daryl's a fantastic performer. Like his physicality is fantastic. So often we kind of give each other little kind of sort of moves or tricks, or if you tried this or this works well in this way. And so organically you come up with new ideas. And one of the advantages of being the disadvantage of having only one actor is if it goes wrong, there's no one to save you. There's no one to remind you what's meant to happen or to get you back on track. But the advantage is you can sort of change stuff if you want to. And Benji, the sound and light operator over here, technical stage manager, and I have been doing the show for a while. And we have a very good understanding of each other. And so if things get changed or go wrong, he's got very good timing and it all works out fine. So at the moment, no plans, but that's because I've just done loads of changes. So probably ask me again in 3 weeks' time and I will probably be able to tell you more things I want to alter.
By the way, you said you've been here a month and the show just opened, playing through December 15th.
No, I will be here a month.
Okay. But well, I'm saying so, but was part of the plan, like, obviously you were here significant amount of time before opening. Was it about let's work on the show, whatever, or did you just want to come to Chicago?
So no, we only got here on Saturday. So we got here and opened on Tuesday. Yeah.
Gotcha. The overall, it will be
Over the month, yes.
Okay, gotcha. And also, you know, you've talked about this is clearly a love letter from a diehard fan, but at the same time, you're reaching people who are, I mean, it's a personal telling, but at the same time, you're also telling the story. I'm sort of curious, which is more operative for you in the production? Is the fan telling the story more operative, or it's the story that's more operative? It just happens to be told by a fan. Does that make sense?
It does make sense, and I think I'm doing both. I am telling you the story of Die Hard while telling the story of what it is to be a fan of Die Hard, and one story takes one night, and one story takes a lifetime. I'm doing them both, and yes, you couldn't do one without the other. The audience are coming for Die Hard. That's what they're there for. They're there because they either love Die Hard, or they're in a relationship with someone who loves Die Hard, or, you know, their producer loves Die Hard, maybe in this case. But I think they leave with not just that, but they leave moved. They leave emotionally moved, I think, by the other story we tell as well as the Die Hard story.
Yeah, it's funny. So I think a lot about the fact that, you know, if you go to a, I don't want to say any actor performer's name, but certain shows where the star might say, well, clearly your spouse dragged you here, you know, or something like that, because it's sometimes one gender or another who's in love with that performer. So here, of course, both genders love Die Hard, but you can see where somebody says, I want to go, and they drag the other along with them, who then has a different experience out of it. Julian, I'll come back to you after this question, but so there are props in the show. First of all, as I will say tongue in cheek, you kind of have to do laundry a lot in this show.
Yes.
Afterwards. But that being said, there are some props, not a lot of props. Actually, there's one prop. I don't even, can I say what it, well, there's animals that are involved in the show. If I don't know if that actually ties to Die Hard or not. I don't know. They're just cute and I love them. I tried to steal one from you when I met you. But that being said, can you talk a little bit about the props? They're simplistic, yet as a performer, obviously you sense the need to go, got to have some visual aids here.
Yeah, so the bear does tie to Die Hard. John brings a bear to his kids at the beginning of the show, and it sits in the back of Argyle's limousine for the rest of the story. So that happened quite organically. Is I was looking at how can you retell these moments from the film in creative ways that both are resonant, hopefully for, you know, for Julian and the Die Hard fans, but also surprising and telling the story in interesting ways. And then I don't want to say too much about this because it will give away what happens at the end of the story.
I didn't.
Yeah, you didn't. You were very good. But the way you realize that it's being told, it makes sense that it's being told with a child's toy and things which you might find around your house. So that's
a perfect example, by the way, of how Julian would have taken that experience different from, because I haven't seen the movie. So I took it in a certain way, appreciating it, but probably not in the way Julian did.
I would imagine it's a different experience. Yes. Yes. But I think what's important is it makes sense for both groups. So it's really important to me that non-diehard fans can enjoy this as a night out at the theater. And I hopefully they do.
Yeah, there's a bar. We're good to go. Julian, back to you as the diehard fan.
Going back to the props, was there a point where you decided we're going to use these specific props versus any other props in the film? Like, what was your selection process? Obviously, the bear was important to setting the scene.
So I think it was a very instinctive decision process. So in adapting, there were sort of two tasks to the telling of this tale, telling the movie story and telling the personal story. And telling a movie story, I anticipated would be a really fun, fairly straightforward process of selecting which bits I want to put in a movie, writing them, and then seeing how long it was and cutting it back or not cutting it back. And that is actually what it turned out to be. It turned out to be a really fun, sort of joyful thing to do that really cheered me up during lockdown. The harder part of writing was telling the personal story because it kept on being too long. And, you know, the reason is that we are used to seeing those kind of romantic story arcs over like 90 minutes or over like 2 hours. That's like a full movie, right? That's a whole genre of movies. And I'm trying to tell it in about 15 minutes within the course of the play. And so I kept sort of writing it and it'd be too long and I'd cut it down. And like, I'm sure you know from scripts, there's times where each cut you make makes sense and you can see where you did it. But a cumulative effect of those cuts is somehow to lose the nature or the quality of what you began with. And it was only when later in the writing process, when I thought I've done so many versions of this story that hadn't really worked, that a friend of mine talked about like a structural change, and I realized that, aha, what I can try to do is all of Die Hard happens on one night, and then all of the personal story happens until the very end on one night, and the anniversary of when they met, and different years, many years later. And I was worried initially that that would be just complicated for an audience to follow and to understand, and it might be bewildering. But we tried it, and it turns out it's actually, I've not given anyone enough credit, and it's perfectly clear to understand. And that unlocked the telling of that part of the tale. And then all the work I'd done before that and the kind of the versions I'd had to cut, all that was then kind of fantastic, fertile compost, and I actually wrote the final version quite quickly. But that was the difficulty of the writing part. I have not answered your question about props, but I will answer it now. The props came very instinctively based on what I thought would be funny and what would be needed, and what, honestly, what wouldn't be too expensive to do and what would be quite portable. So that kind of, there's a practicality to it as well.
Although the bear does take up a seat, I will say that, on an airplane, but...
he's sizable, yes.
Yes. If I'm giving something up, I'll apologize. I think it's okay to give this up, because Die Hard is filled with guns and shooting and all that kind of stuff. And I will go ahead and say, stop me if I shouldn't, but there are no guns that appear in your show. I mean, you fake them and all of that. I'm sort of curious. It reminded me of when Lin-Manuel Miranda, during the Tonys back several years ago, when there had just been a shooting, he decided to have a number performed without a number that uses muskets, and he took them out and did not allow the actors to use that. I'm sort of curious, not that you knew about that, but was that a conscious decision that we're going to, it's full of guns, but we're not about to do that with kids in the audience or whatever?
So, I remember that night. Is that when he did his Love Is Love Is Love Is Love?
Same night.
As well, same, yeah. Night.
But that was, but he did, but it was the scene from Hamilton where there'd be muskets, yeah. And shooting, and he didn't allow it.
Right. So, I mean, what a wonderful writer he is. What an inspiration. The reason that there's no guns actually is twofold. One is that I don't think you need them. I think that but also it's much quicker to not have them, because I'm switching between roles so fast. If I had to put things down and pick them up, it would be at the wrong point in the stage, and it would take time. And one of the things incumbent on you in a one-person show, I think, is to the time. If I'm switching from being one character to another, the time in that switch is dead time. And it's time when that character would be responding immediately or interrupt. You can't interrupt yourself, but characters normally don't leave pauses before the other person speaks. And so I'm trying to make that switch as quick as I can. And so anything you can do to facilitate that transfer, I would do. And so again, that would have been an instinctive decision I didn't sort of consciously make, that if I can use my fingers and people can understand what's going on, that just makes it much faster.
It was a production decision, not necessarily a political one.
Yeah, absolutely.
Julian, final question.
Big, super important question. How many times have you seen Die Hard?
Whoa. Ooh. I mean, hundreds. It's going to be hundreds. Like many times as a Die Hard fan. And then when I came to write it, I wrote down before, when I made a decision to write it, I wrote down all of the most iconic moments that I love from the movie before I rewatched it. And all of those are in the stage show. Then, in the making of it, I've watched it countless times, not just as a movie, but at watching scenes, partly to study them, partly to see what the actors are doing when I later came to perform it. But yeah, just hundreds of times now. And I still love it. Like, it was on, it's on, I think it's on Hulu over here. So I put it on the other morning. I love it.
Great question. A great way to end. Please watch Goldfinger. I'd like your next production to be about Goldfinger and Ian Fleming's James Bond. I'll come see that too. I've seen that lots. Richard March, congratulations. What a clever, interesting approach. Took both Julian and I by surprise the way it was presented and performed. Just amazing. And Yippee-ki-yay is going to play at the Broadway Playhouse through December 15th. Great environment to do a show. I'm sure you're enjoying the Chicago audiences within that really intimate space. And enjoy your time in Chicago. I have other places to send you. We'll talk about that. But for now, you can get tickets at BroadwayInChicago.com. Thank you. Enjoy Chicago, mate. Oh, wait, that was Australian, my friend.
Thank you very much. I'm having a great time, and I intend to continue to do so. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.